All right, let's ask the pastor. We had so many good phone calls and questions yesterday, it almost wore me out. But I know that's not really true. When you ask questions, then I just kind of lean back and enjoy the conversation. So why don't you come in, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, if you'd like to join our conversation here on Ask the Pastor. Our guest here is with us from Hobart, Indiana, Trinity Lutheran Church, Pastor Gary Nagy. Boy, we've just had a whole bunch of Indiana guys here in the last week. Greenwood, Indiana, Churubusco, Indiana, Portage, Indiana now, Pastor Gary Nagy. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm well, thanks.
Do you have adverse weather?
Yes.
We're
part of that lake effect thing that they all show on the national map. But
Lake effect. That's what they were telling us in Portage, Indiana, that they had the lake effect going on there. Are you close to Portage?
Yes, actually we're adjoining.
Ah. Well, how is the lake effect these days?
Well, it's been pretty good this year. It usually runs a little bit closer to South Bend and then that corner of Michigan, the bottom left hand of the mitten, if you look at Michigan,
yeah,
like a big fist. And they've had over 2 feet. This wind hit closer to the west side of the lake, so we're picking up a little bit today.
So is there any such thing as a summertime lake effect?
Yes. There are some storms that come out of Canada and run south, and sometimes our storms can actually run 600 miles south, which I'm pretty sure puts us into Alabama. So we sort of reciprocate for all the hurricane rain they send up to us.
Well, maybe you and I would be better off if we were in San Francisco today. I don't know what the temperature is out in San Francisco. We have 11 above here, and I know you're well below freezing there. Maybe it's nice out in San Francisco. I might have to take a look at the weather out there. But I have a story from San Francisco, which I thought I would share with you today. You know, you being a pastor, you probably were a model child right from the very beginning and never got into any trouble. Your mom never, for example, washed your mouth out with soap, did she?
Well, no, but I wasn't a model child either.
Oh, really?
No.
Well, we won't probe too deeply into that.
Right. Well, you have to wait for my wife's book. She's writing a biography to make up for all the things people think about pastors as being very saintly.
Well, I'm old enough to remember at least the possibility of having your mouth washed out with soap.
Oh, sure. Yeah, me too.
Oh, you can remember that. Okay. I mean, and that was, you know, that was something that from time to time was even a kind of a threat in public school. If you got foul or vulgar with your language, you could suffer a consequence. Oh, how things have changed.
Oh, boy, yes.
Instead of the authorities or the people in charge in school or parents teaching us a lesson by sticking a bar of soap in our mouth, making us gag, we have this story out of San Francisco today. The headline is, San Francisco official vows to curse at every city meeting. A San Francisco supervisor known for outrageous behavior reportedly cursed at a city hall meeting and promised to use profanities during every board meeting for the remainder of 2010. Chris Daly said, now this is where you might want to cover the kids' ears here. I'm not going to be graphic or anything, but Chris Daly said he was upset about a Bay Guardian newspaper article taking the supervisor to task about his previous usage of the F word during a rules committee meeting on Thursday, according to Channel 5 CBS in San Francisco. Daly said, quote, I do want to warn the easily offended. I just updated my Facebook page vowing that in 2010 I'll use the F word in every board of supervisors meeting, unquote. Asked if he were serious, Daly told CBS 5 or CB5.com, quote, it was serious as far as spur-of-the-moment Facebook status updates go. Happy New Year, unquote. We're approaching the place where I it's so upside down and so inverted that I don't know what to do with it anymore.
Right.
Is your advice just to look the other way, you know, nothing really to see here, move on, should Christians in San Francisco, should Christians maybe in California respond to this?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't know. Obviously, Americans cherish their right to free speech. Sometimes it's offensive. Christians certainly are offended, I think, not just with the use of what we would classify as four-letter words, but more of the taking of God's name in vain, the incessant, oh my God, which even appears on text messages as OMG, which I tell the eighth grade confirmation class is still a sin because...
Hold on, you can't do that? That's wrong?
Well, God's name is very precious to him because it is who he is. And so one of the first three commandments, of course, talks about taking his name in vain. So that would certainly have a Christian be mindful of respect.
Well, you know, you got a whole bunch of people right now thinking, OMG, well, I do that all the time. That you're saying that's a sin?
Well, again, I would imagine it probably has to do with the intent. Some people just do it because it fills air or it's some sort of a response that they feel is at least acknowledging what has been said. But you know, God's name is God's name, and I tell folks, you know, you can replace it maybe by saying, "Oh my gosh," and maybe some clever person might say, "Well, that's what I'm texting when I say OMG. I'm really saying, oh my gosh." And I guess it all depends on the heart at that point, what the heart is saying. Is the heart really wanting to say, oh my God, and knows that, oh, I'll get in trouble if I say it, so I'll have to...
Well, I'll tell you what,
so
Pastor, the heart's just not really thinking about it all that much. You know, you're just minding your own business, and then something amazing happens or something... horrible happens, and out comes OMG.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's wrong.
Well, sin doesn't have to be, how do I want to say this? You don't have to be completely aware of a sin to be a sin. You know, you can't talk yourself out of a speeding ticket just because you can claim you didn't know what the speed limit was. You're still going to get a ticket because ignorance of the law is no defense. And so... God says, don't use my name in vain. That was written into the heart of people at the time of Adam and Eve. Obviously, it's very cloudy. Certainly, I think Jesus, when he talks about what proceeds out of the heart, you know, the false testimonies and the murders and the adulteries and all those kinds of things, is telling us that that's just human nature. And you're right. It just kind of comes out. Christians, however, have... yet another nature that they wish to look at more closely.
Well, you know, some pastors actually serve in elected offices. I guess that happens from time to time. If it happened that you were a member of this board of supervisors, you had a seat at the table, and you served with this gentleman who has promised to use what I would call vulgarities at in the meeting. Do you think you'd just bear it? Do you think that you would address it publicly in the context of the meeting, the formal context of the meeting? Do you think you'd invite him to lunch? What would you do?
Well, I think I would have a conversation with him just to let him know that there are sensitivities on the other side. You know, if it's a vulgarity that involves what we typically call the four-letter words, I'm not so sure God is as concerned about us having manners as he is about us misusing his name. Of course, those vulgarities are often used hand in hand with his name, and so my concern would be the misuse of God's most holy name, his name itself, in whatever form that appears.
So, one thing that I find interesting here in this story, obviously written by a secular news organization, It says, a San Francisco supervisor known for outrageous behavior reportedly cursed at a city hall meeting and promised to use profanities during every board meeting for the remainder of 2010. And then the quote that they have here in this news story is, I just updated my Facebook page vowing that in 2010 I'll use the F word in every board of supervisors meeting. Now, there is a difference between a vulgarity, an obscenity, and a profanity. Is there not? Or do you just view those as interchangeable terms?
Oh, I guess I've never parsed the words out fully in English, so I just sort of lazily lump them into things that are offensive to common decency.
That's my understanding, and I haven't looked it up, so you know, I could be wrong here, that profanity is a word that is tied to the deity. A person can be vulgar, a person can be obscene, but when a person profanes something, that directly involves God, does it not?
Well, yes, that word does appear in Scripture about profaning the Lord and those things that belong to the Lord, profaning the altar, for instance, because it's connected to the Lord. When I grew up, I was taught that even making a little cross my heart and hope to die, if used as a cover-up for a lie, is that the truth? Well, cross my heart and hope to die, we're actually making a sign of the cross, and you're asking for something that happened that only God can do, is an indirect profaning of his name.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jan, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
I was wondering if in Revelation, is everything up until chapter 20, verse 7, already passed, and from there on, that's the yet to come? And if so, is that considered a partial preterist point of view?
All right, now here's what we're going to do, Jan. I appreciate your question. But one thing that we like to do with our Ask the Pastor guests is not just back the Revelation truck up and dump it on their feet here. So if Pastor Nagy's not quite prepared to answer this, we're going to be understanding, okay?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Pastor Nagy, we've been studying the book of Revelation in our 10 o'clock hour, the first hour of the Bible study here on our radio station. And today we were blessed to have Dr. Louis Brighton.
Oh, man.
He dealt with verses 7 through 10 in Revelation 20. Yesterday, we talked about verses 1 through 6 in Revelation 20, and as you can probably guess, we talked at considerable length about the millennium, the 1,000 years that is depicted there. And Dr. Brighton flat out, in unequivocal way, said that Tim LaHaye, without any prompting from me, by the way, that Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey are wrong on the 1,000 years, and he went on to explain that the 1,000 years is a symbolic period in Revelation, referring to the period of time between Christ's ascension and just before his second coming. So it appears that Jan's question in from Revelation 20 is everything up to Revelation 20, verse 7, already happened, I think. Now, are you in a position to do that, or is that something that you need to look at a little bit before you deal with it, or how do you want to handle it?
Well, I can address it briefly. I haven't taught Revelation in some time, but it's interesting that the Sunday morning Bible class has just picked another topic, and they've picked the topic, the end times, which includes very much, of course, the book of Revelation. Some of us are going out tonight to see the Mayan understanding of 2012, which is another aspect of how people look at the end times, along with the Left Behind series and those kinds of things. And my basic understanding of the book of Revelation is that it's all picture language, and it's a story of, it looks like the bad guy's winning until the very end, when the good guy triumphs, because he's really triumphed all along. The bad guy doesn't know that he's whooped when he got whooped. And that's, of course, Jesus dying on the cross and taking the bullets out of the gun that Satan holds against us for for our sins, since Jesus paid for the sins. So I would say that I view the book of Revelation more as not a line that you would draw from Christ's ascension to Christ's return, as much as it is a picture of history between that time, which you of course described as the 1,000 years, which is a perfect number for the Greek mind, by the way. I mean, it's a cube, 10 times 10 times 10. You know, in their geometry and in their mathematics, that'd be a perfect number. It is just a picture of things that are unfolding. Don't be surprised. Hang in there, because what happens at the end is all worth the things that we go through in the trials of life.
So, Jan, I would say this based on what our pastors have brought to the table in the book of Revelation through our study thus far, but I could be wrong because I'm just a layperson like the people who call here, most of the folks who call. But the 1,000 years that are described in verses 1 through 6 of Revelation 20 are that period, as Dr. Brighton pointed out today, in which we are now. So if I understood your question, has everything before verse 7 in Revelation 20 already happened? I think the answer to that would be no. It has happened, is happening, and will continue to happen until the Lord Jesus comes back. I think that would be the correct answer to the question, but I am certainly willing to stand corrected if Pastor Nagy or somebody else wants to call in and correct me. Let's take another call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Leo. You're next on the Bible study.
Good morning, Pastor, and good morning, Professor Rathard. I have a question for you in terms of the original subject you brought up, Mr. Rathard.
Yes, sir.
What about that text, you will be held accountable for every careless word you utter? I believe that's in Scripture. And what's the extent of careless word, in your opinion? I'll get off the line. Thank
All right.
you so much.
Thank you for the call. Well, that can't just really mean that, can it, Pastor?
Well, I think it's words that are spoken without thought. It's oaths that are made with the intent to lie. I'm not sure if it extends all the way down to a slip of the tongue or what we would call obscenities or vulgarisms in our language, sense of that, in our language. I think the carelessness has to come with the understanding of the human nature, and that even Christians can be careless and things slip. One of my favorite sayings from Martin Luther is, you can't prevent birds from flying over your head, but you can certainly keep them from building nests in them. And so, you know, if a careless word is slipped, obviously that's a wonderful time to ask God to forgive and to recall or be told by somebody, or to read in his word that the forgiveness is there, it's complete, it's immediate. God says this hasn't damaged our relationship in any way. Let's move on. And so I think a careful study of that might lead to those kinds of conclusions. I recall in the Old Testament there were the cities of refuge that if somebody was killed accidentally, the person who committed the accidental murder could flee for refuge and could not be held accountable in the sense of the family coming and seeking retribution or vengeance. I call those oops sins. And the example I think they give in the Old Testament is the axe flies off the handle and it kills somebody. Well, that's different than, you know, premeditated murder, of course. So I think careless words are always spoken. We're always living in a condition of sin, but it's wonderful to know that we also live in a condition of grace as both saint and sinner at the same time.
So the president of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, his name is David Chu, He said that he is checking to see if Daley's pledge violated any city rules or regulations. Chu also asked Daley not to use that kind of language and left a bar of soap at Daley's office. Hence my previous bar of soap reference.
Okay, I wonder if what kind it was, because, you know, certain bars of soap taste pretty good. If you've ever seen The Christmas Story, Lifebuoy had a certain pecan flavor.
Oh, well. This president of the Board of Supervisors, Chu, said that he told him, "I thought he could do better." A spokesman for San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom suggested that Daley's colleagues start a, quote-unquote, swear jar to make Daley pay for every time he uses profanities during official meetings. So I guess my question for you, Pastor Nagy, is do we really have to have a law every time we ask a question like this? Is it possible to have a common understanding of public decorum? And I think the common understanding of public decorum is that you don't use vulgar and offensive language in a public setting like this. I think you have to really search long and far to find somebody who would be in favor of that kind of vulgarity in a public setting. We don't have to have a law to tell us that, do we, Pastor? If you were the chairman of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, if you had the gavel and you ran the meeting, do you think you'd be so bold as to say, I am not going to permit that in my meeting as long as I'm the chairman? If that is out of step with the rest of you folks, then you can have another chairman. But as long as I'm chairman, there will be no swearing here. And then, boom, bang your gavel down on the table, and that's the way we're going. If the gentleman will not comply, there is something called a sergeant at arms, and you could have him removed. Now, is there any room in the scenario for that kind of administration, or do you think I'm way out of line?
Well, you know, we're getting into the separation of church and state and how I feel as an individual citizen. Am I offended simply because common decency would, you know, basically reject?
You don't have to be in the church to have common decency. You can be a pagan and.
Oh, right. And I'm, you know, those are the things that are written in the heart. The basic premises of the Ten Commandments were all heartfelt. And, you know, I would probably ignore it because some people do things to get attention, and when you don't pay any attention to them, that can it can tend to go away. My guess is that there is a law on the San Francisco books, because there seems to be a law in every city that dates back to 1870s that basically says no vulgarisms, along with the no spitting on the sidewalk kind of things. And I'm sure that was an attempt by previous generations to control these things, but truth be told, I'm not so sure that laws work on getting this kind of thing done. It's you know, I am offended by it. I talk to a person about being offended by it, but, you know, I can only be at peace with that person if that person's at peace with me. That's what St. Paul says, as much as you are able, be at peace with all people. You can do your part, but they have to do their part, and then they're held accountable.
So we have two men here, one who says that this is inappropriate conduct, and here's a bar of soap. And we have another man who says, oh, yeah, well, I'm telling you what, in every meeting in 2010, this is the way I'm going to behave myself. We're supposed to be in an age of tolerance here. Who is supposed to tolerate whom in this setting?
Well, I suppose society always thinks that the rabble-rouser needs to be tolerated because of the fierce position Americans especially take on independence and freedom of the individual. And so that's probably how, in an unwritten sense, society would say, well, you should just let him speak his piece because everybody's entitled to. Usually it falls on people who, you know, those kinds of words are spoken in a setting where people really don't care to hear it, but try to go someplace where you don't hear it. You can overhear a conversation at a restaurant, and the question is, you know, if you go over and say enough.
Hold your thought right there, okay. Pastor Nagy. We're going to take our bottom of the hour break, and we'll return on this subject right after these 4 minutes.
On Friday's Essence, we wrap up the work week thusly. We'll talk with Professor Adi Harstad from Trinity Lutheran Theological Seminary in Mankato, Minnesota, on the strange account in Joshua about the waters of the Jordan piling up in a heap. Connie Grotefend joins us from Trinity Lutheran Church in Edwardsville, and Dr. Timothy Moschke from Concordia Mequot as well. Lots of music, Christian companionship, The Essence, with me, Diane Summers, from 1 to 4 p.m. on KFUO Radio. We are where you are.
On the next Adventures in Odyssey, the Whisperer closes in on his prize.
I'm looking forward to this, Jason. I'll finally get to meet your father face to face.
Don't count on it. It's his bowling night.
Your father wouldn't sit idly by and allow me to just waltz in and take applesauce.
He would to save my life.
Will Witt turn over a deadly weapon to save his own son's life? Find out on the next Adventures in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on KFUO Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Have you ever seen the fast-moving, slippery slope of euthanasia? Here's an excellent case in point. 4 years ago, the United Kingdom passed the Mental Capacity Act with the help of their Prime Minister, Tony Blair. The law meant to allow terminally ill patients the right to decline treatment. So far, so good, you say? Well, it went bad very quickly. Just 2 years later, a 20-something woman swallowed antifreeze to commit suicide and left a note for doctors not to treat her. The doctors did nothing to help because of the Mental Capacity Act. An investigation backed up the doctors. The net result has been that this act was used to legalize suicide in just a couple of years. And the door's been opened wide for euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. A slippery slope indeed.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Muslim Outreach. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. President Barack Obama says keeping America safe will require more than tightening security.
We must communicate clearly to Muslims around the world that Al-Qaeda offers nothing except a bankrupt vision of misery and death, including the murder of fellow Muslims, while the United States stands with those who seek justice and progress.
The president said he knows
the vast majority of Muslims reject Al-Qaeda. But it is clear that Al-Qaeda increasingly seeks to recruit individuals without known terrorist affiliations, not just in the Middle East, but in Africa and other places, to do their bidding.
To stymie those efforts, Obama said,
we've sought new beginnings with Muslim communities around the world, one in which we engage on the basis of mutual interest and mutual respect, and work together to fulfill the aspirations that all people share, to get an education, to work with dignity, to live in peace and security.
I'm Steve Coleman.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. As the Christian year continues, this weekend we take a look at the baptism of our Lord Jesus. The book of the prophet Isaiah talks about baptism in general, when it tells us, fear not, I have redeemed you, I have called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. We'll talk about Jesus' baptism and our baptism this week on In His Steps.
Saturday at noon on KFUO Radio.
Are you a pastor or a congregational leader interested in keeping the people in your parish up to date on what's happening with the pro-life movement? Well, here's a resource from Lutherans for Life. It's titled Life News, and it's a series of monthly bulletin inserts that you can use for distribution at your church. For more information on this very helpful resource, simply go to lutheransforlife.org. Look for information on Life News monthly bulletin inserts. You listen to the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour, the open phone hour, where you can call in with questions and comments on the subjects that we're talking about or any of the subjects that you might want to raise. 505-785-1800-730-2727 if you too would like to join the program. Our guest today is Pastor Gary Nagy, pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Hobart, Indiana. It was kind of an awkward interruption that I imposed on you there, Pastor. Are you able
No. I remember watching the clock because this hour goes so fast.
Can you pick it up where you left off?
Well, yeah, and the thought that I think I was going to finish that with was Jesus in his prayer about us, the disciples and us and John, called the high priestly prayer. It says, Father, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one in the world. And so we are called upon to be a presence, and we just live out our lives focused on Jesus. I wouldn't be upset by the vulgarisms. I think a comment would be made to a person who misused God's name, but then again, is that person a believer? Well, then you have to wonder about the whole attitude of the heart anyway. So,
all right, here's another question I have for you. You live up there in Hobart, Indiana. You were telling us about the lake effect. I'm familiar a little bit with the summer lake effect because it has a way of blowing baseballs back into Wrigley Field or out of Wrigley Field sometimes. Are you a Cub fan, Pastor Nagy?
Well, yes, until my daughters married Sox fans, and then we...
Oh, my goodness. Now what are you going to do?
Well, we have those hats that one side says Cubs and the other bill says, you know, Sox. So.
Well, now that's a...
But I've been to both stadiums.
That's a disappointing compromise, I have to say, Pastor.
Peace in the family, you know.
All right, I'm going to go with that. Well, we have a pitcher on our team down here in St. Louis who is a pretty fine pitcher. He was a candidate for the Cy Young Award this year, and I'm talking about Adam Wainwright. And, you know, I don't know Adam Wainwright any more than the rest of us. There was a very interesting story on him in the local newspaper back when it appeared that he had a decent shot to become the Cy Young Award winner. It didn't work out that way. The San Francisco pitcher got that. But we like Adam down here. You probably don't like him up there if you're a Cub fan, but...
Just on certain days.
But, you know, I don't have any reason to not like Adam Wainwright. He's an excellent pitcher. He's been a fine role model, as far as I can tell, in his rather prominent place as a Major League Baseball player. But there's a story coming out of Jefferson City today that I thought might be interesting to take up with you, and it says that Adam Wainwright sometimes looks like he's sniffing his glove between pitches. The St. Louis Cardinals pitcher often is actually talking to God. For Wainwright, prayer is an integral part of his rising career. Before games, during games, and even as postseason awards are being passed out, Wainwright was the keynote speaker Thursday at the Missouri Governor's annual prayer breakfast in Jefferson City. At a news conference following the prayer breakfast, Wainwright said he prays before games that God will strengthen him, quote, and let the other team look at me in fear, unquote. And when he raises his glove to his face between pitches, Wainwright says, what I'm actually doing is talking to God or talking to myself, just asking for strength. Now, does this sound to you like fine biblical Christian discipline, or is it a little strange? And please, if you can, filter out your Cub prejudice.
Well, that's always hard to do, but... Well, I think talking to God is encouraged in the Bible. James says the reason that things don't happen is because we just make our plans, never saying if God wills. And so his point is that we live and should live as Christians in light of not what we want, but what the Lord wants. I could certainly see any ball player asking God for strength and for direction. The fear of God, I've never heard that where the other team would have a fear of him because of his greatness. Maybe that became what was the problem that Samson wound up with, a little bit of a braggadocio, a little bit of a boasting about, yeah, I cut my hair. And then they can take advantage of that. You know, pastors up here this is big football country too for high school, and we get, you know, prayer requests all the time, you know, that our team win or something. And I say, well, I'm not going to go that far. I'm not going to do something. I'm just going to ask for, you know, everybody to be healthy and safe. Everybody play to their best. And, everybody say their own private prayers because that way there the Lord has a choice, you know, team A or team B. And that's how it works out. So, it's probably, in my mind, a little bit of both. You know, I think it's great that he has that conversation. I remember Oral Hershiser with the Los Angeles Dodgers would do those kinds of things too, and he would sing hymns in between and stuff like that. I guess in our day and age, you look at somebody like that kind of suspect, like maybe they're not all there. And that's easier to do. I mean, remember, I remember one time before I was married, I was doing my laundry at a corn-operated laundromat, and the lady just got down on her knees and started talking, I think in tongues. Obviously, it was a prayer, but I was, you know, I moved my card a little bit further away. Now, the problem, of course, is everybody's got those things that they stick in their ears, and they're talking to people on the phone, so you don't know if they're talking to God or their wife about, you know, is it macaroni and cheese I'm supposed to pick up, so... That's an interesting story. I'll have to try to follow up on
Well, I guess the bottom line is, if you're an athlete and you're a Christian, he's not saying that he's praying that the Cardinals beat the Cubs. If he's facing the Cubs, he's not asking God to deliver the Cubs into his hands here, but he wants to compete at the highest level possible. Is it appropriate for an athlete who is a Christian to talk to God before the game, during the game, asking for strength so that he can compete at the highest level? Is that an appropriate prayer?
Oh, I would think so. I mean,
it's okay.
You know, whether we eat or drink or whatever we do, Paul says, you know, you give the glory to God, and so you ask God for protection and for help and assistance in those things.
All right, here's another story from Minneapolis. It says two county attorneys in Minnesota, they will not file charges against a man who investigators say admitted posting anti-Muslim cartoons in front of a mosque. The cartoons are posted in front of a mosque, a Somali-owned store, and a number of other spots. Authorities say the cartoons show obscene images. Here we are back to obscenity now. Authorities say the cartoons show obscene images of Muhammad and an Islamic crescent with a swastika inside it. Mahmoud Muhammad, a Somali activist in St. Cloud, Minnesota, says they reflect a violent mindset. And Mayor Dave Kleiss says he thinks the man should face legal consequences. But the chief prosecutors in Stearns and Benton counties say the cartoons are protected speech. St. Cloud City Attorney Jan Peterson says the man might still be charged with a misdemeanor. And here we are, in some ways, back around to the original subject that I brought up with you.
Different way.
You know, we've seen somebody take a crucifix and place it into a jar of urine.
Yep.
Give it a name and call it art. We've seen, I don't know, what was it, a depiction of the Virgin Mary with dung slung upon it, called art, and we were told at that time, well, this is all protected by the Constitution. I'm not obviously a Muslim, but I'm offended by this, and I feel for the Muslims who are offended by this. I'm not quite sure which way to go with it. Do you think that the man should be charged, maybe just with a misdemeanor at least, or do you think it's protected speech?
Oh, I don't know, and honestly, I don't care. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, good. At least you're honest.
I mean, I feel badly, like you do, for the folks that have to be subjected to this, but golly, they've been doing that with Christians for an awful long time, too. And it's just a matter of, we understand that point of view. Jesus says, you will be persecuted for my name's sake. And don't think that you're any better than I am, because they didn't think a lot of me. I mean, he's talking about the leaders of the time that that brought about his crucifixion and death. And so, you know, we're exposed to all of these kinds of things. Obviously, as a major world religion, the Muslims are too, and the offense is there. Do I get up in arms? Am I upset if they do or don't? I don't know. I still say there are plenty of she-bears in the woods. And by that I mean there's a passage, and I get, you can probably help me on this. Elijah, Elisha, you know, he's walking down somewhere, and some kids are making fun of him, and they say, go up, old Baldy. You know, they're just kind of mocking him, and a she-bear comes out of the woods and eats like 48 of them. Well, that's a tragedy. I'm basically saying by that story, I'm understanding that, you know, God doesn't need us to protect him. And we can certainly live and turn the other cheek and be supportive of anybody who feels offended and should feel offended because a picture of something that's perceived to be good and right, you know, like a religion, is being downgraded. I don't know what else to say. It's the dealer's choice, free speech. Yeah, we live in a country like that. In some other countries, you know, that wouldn't be as free.
Well, you know, in our conversation with Dr. Brighton here in Revelation 20 in the hour just preceding this one, he pretty much communicated that as we make our way through the symbolic millennium, which is the church age, the period we're in now, that just before Jesus returns, it's going to get really terrible. And, I mean, he didn't mince words. There won't be any Bibles. Churches will be torn down. You won't be able to worship people who, the way he described it, people who witness to Jesus are going to be put to death. They're going to be tortured. He said it's going to be terrible. And, you know, I said, well, do you have grandchildren, Dr. Brighton? Are you motivated for your great-grandchildren to do something to steer away from an outcome like that, or is it just something that's coming and there's really nothing we can do about it?
Okay.
He said, what you need to do is prepare your children to go through it. They may not have to go through it, but they should be prepared to go through it.
Okay.
And he did not say, oh no, here's a 7-point plan on how we can postpone, Armageddon. So
God's word is so true that it's going to come true if he says it's going to happen. And so if we re-divert it or delay it like you were talking about, yeah. But it's going to happen. And so Jesus was, when he talked about the end times, was just, and the persecution that his own disciples would face after he ascended is like, yeah, be prepared. It's going to happen. And lift your head high because it's a badge of honor that somebody thinks you that way because that's basically what they think of me, and that's an honor, indirectly, even though it appears like it's a left-handed compliment.
Well, when you responded the way you did, and you said, you know, I really don't care, that seemed to me to be sort of consistent with, they're going to be people who are insulting Muslims, and they're going to be people insulting Christians, and they're going to be people insulting Jews. Go out and tell somebody about Jesus. And if we're here for another 100 years, great. And if we're here for another 100 days, great. But just go tell somebody about Jesus. Does that pretty much sum it up?
Wow. That's great. Yeah, that sums up what I said. And to be linked with Dr. Brighton, golly. I mean, you know, next to John, he's probably the most wise person there is about the book of Revelation. Of course, he probably knew John personally. I'm just kidding. I had him in school 30 years ago. So the man's been around a long time and certainly is very knowledgeable. But, yeah, expect it. Hold your head up and be proud because you belong to Jesus and he's got a hold of you and won't let you go.
All right, here's another subject that I'd like to take up with you here before we get too far out of time. The headline is U.S. Pastors Encouraged to Join National Marriage Week Effort. The story says pastors and pro-family leaders across America are being encouraged to take part in a week-long effort next month to help strengthen, enrich, and repair marriages in their churches and in their communities. National Marriage Week USA, which will be observed the week leading up to Valentine's Day, is a collaborative effort to encourage churches and many diverse groups to strengthen individual marriages, reduce the divorce rate, and build a stronger marriage culture, which organizers say in turn helps curtail poverty and benefits children. So, Pastor Nagy, you're in a position to say, that's a good idea, or maybe just like the other thing, nah, I don't care. Which is it?
Well, I'd say both. I mean, I think the church is in the business of helping people in marriages. Obviously, it's an institution ordained by God. He has wonderful plans and promises for it. Sometimes, because of the work of the evil one in the world, marriages aren't all that they could be, and might even be the exact opposite of what God intended them to be. And so, that's an ongoing kind of thing. you deal with the family from time to time. But once in a while, just like in the church, in our own denomination, Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, an idea comes up to concentrate, focus your attention on that for a little bit. Yeah, if it raises the issue in terms of visibility and makes people think and makes people a little bit more committed, yeah, that's fine.
Well, you said, 30 years in the ministry? Is that what I understood you to say?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen an evolution in the institution of marriage over the course of those 30 years? Have you got enough slice of experience to tell me whether it's pretty much stayed the same, gotten better, gotten worse?
Well, statistically, and I did a study of the people in a congregation that were married from 1948 on. As far as we can know, just to see what a half century looked like. And the divorce rate's about the same as it was before. I think there's a point or two off, 24%, 26%. There doesn't seem to be anything about the longer you're married, the better the chances are of staying married. You know, people 25, 30 years, you might attribute that maybe to change of life issues, too, that people are looking at things differently. I don't see it all that different. Probably there's nothing new under the sun. It may look different. It might be more apparent because people are more vocal about it. I mean, we talked about how, you know, obscenities have just kind of come onto the everyday life almost with a vengeance. And you know, probably these things were going on behind closed doors that nobody knew about decades ago, but now everybody talks about it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of TMI out there, too much information. I don't need to know that.
So as a pastor working with married couples and their various distresses, do you think that a week leading up to Valentine's Day and a focus on advancing marriage is a good idea?
Well, anything that works. I mean, you know, we do the couples retreats, and those seem to be helpful in some cases. I would take it back to Jesus as, if you're not against me, you're for me. And so everything that would certainly be pure and wholesome, Paul talks about everything that's good and nice and kind, think about those things. What can it hurt? I hate to say this, but it's sort of like the chicken soup understanding. You know, have some chicken soup because you have a cold. It won't hurt you, at least, you know. So, yeah, but I think God takes those things and he blesses them and he uses them for his own purposes. And especially with the debate now, I was listening to a Religion and Something Weekly that's put out in the state of Indiana, and it's a half-hour program about certain topics and such on the public television station, and a lot of it had to do with the challenges that the churches are going to face in the next decade, the decade I guess we're in, like it had to do with same-sex marriage. So, yeah, anything that refocuses the attention on what God thought this, God said this should be like, and is a good idea. Yeah, that's great.
One of the campaign organizers was quoted as saying, "There is no question that more needs to be done within our congregations to create a more thriving marriage culture and assist marriages and families to remain happily intact." Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, sure. For everything. I mean, people need to be more spiritually nice to each other. People need to be come stronger at being better parents, and kids need to be stronger at becoming better children. Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Even more concerning, they say, is 40% of all American children today are born out of wedlock, 4 out of 10 born out of wedlock, and 71% of African American children are born without married parents. Now, these are certainly statistics that when you began in the ministry 30 years ago, I don't think those statistics were in place at that time. I don't think it was that serious, but it is now. One of the organizers says, "Children not brought up by both a mother and father have lower graduation rates, higher incidence of incarceration, and lower performance in school. For the sake of women and children, the church must get involved to strengthen, enrich, and repair marriage." Now, the way it's depicted here, it sounds like a crisis, Pastor. Do you agree that it is a crisis?
Well, I don't know what the definition of crisis is. Is there more than not? Yeah, there seems to be. And I think that becomes the problem when we try to manage these things. I mean, you know, we have a Christian day school, and 3-year-old through 8th grade, and we have 110 kids. And, yeah, some of them are going through, families are going through divorces, and sometimes we've got, parent A against parent B, and the child's involved, and it just seems like, yeah, there's a spirit of not wanting to do anything cooperatively. And yeah, so I would say since it demands a lot of our time and our resources, that's absolutely true. And so something needs to be done for the sake of the children. I don't like those things where they talk about it, well, there's more incidences of this, that, or the other thing, almost as if undertone they're saying, and you know, this is going to cost you money, taxpayer, because you're going to have to pay for this stuff in the future. Yeah, okay, I understand that that's a reason to cut, you know, head stuff off, but, you know, Jesus was always concerned about the individual, and my heart's going out to the little girl who told my wife, who's a teacher at our school, you know, mommy and daddy are breaking up, and they just have a hard time with it. So, you know, chapel, okay, we have baptism recognitions, and it's like, okay, baptism puts you in God's family, that God is your father, and you have a big brother who's going to fight for you, and they'll never walk away from you. They're always there for you. Those kinds of things are great words of encouragement and comforting as those children express their fears in a world that, yeah, 30 years ago, it wasn't that bad.
Well, it says here that 1 month before National Marriage Week, which means pretty soon here, organizers will host a free webinar to inform pastors and other interested marriage and family leaders how they can incorporate a National Marriage Week USA emphasis into what they are already doing at their churches to strengthen and support marriage and families. And I'm not going to put you on the spot here. I'm not going to ask you to tell me whether or not you're going to watch this. But it's scheduled for January 13th, 9 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time, 12 p.m. Eastern time. I guess that would be 11 o'clock for you and me, depending on where you are in Indiana there. I know you got a strange timeline there. But does this sound like something that you might be interested in doing? It's free. You can get on the computer and check it out.
You know, I'm probably going to sound like a bad pastor, but we've got a lot of resources, and we've got a lot of people that use the resources. This may be yet another resource. But my concern is that the position from where somebody comes, because a lot of times it's not a gospel position. Sometimes, while well-intended, it sort of has a law overtone. It's sort of like, well, you're going to do this, you know, and it's almost like, you know, the attitude is, well, if you stop doing this bad thing, then you're a Christian. And Jesus never told somebody to stop doing something. He didn't want to see that anymore. Jesus always wanted to capture the heart, reclaim the heart, be the savior of the heart, and then be the king of the heart. And so while that might have some good things, I don't know. If I'm available, I might look at it. If not, I'm sure God uses other resources that we already have available to work on this.
Well, let's do this. If you do check it out and find it to be productive, you maybe can send me an email and say, hey, Chuck, I looked at it, and I can recommend it. And if you don't even want to deal with it, you don't need to tell us. But it does seem to me like you have a serious attitude about what we can do to help preserve biblical, dignified marriage in our culture, and I appreciate your comments.
And, Chuck, just for you, I will do this.
Oh, well, God bless you, sir. There aren't a whole lot of people that say that to me.
Well, no, I don't mind helping out, and you know, people come and tell me what they've seen and what they think about something, and you know, that's helpful.
All right, well, down the road maybe we'll find out what your thoughts were.
Okay.
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you.
Wow, let's go check it out. I probably have to send him a reminder. Pastor Gary Nagy, Trinity Hobart, Indiana.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at the same time on the Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.